Would Russia really invade Ukraine? Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin speaking by video link after more than a month of escalation in the east of that country and across the Russian border, where a troops buildup's got NATO allies warning of red lines, harsh sanctions if those Russian troops do indeed cross over. We'll be debriefing that virtual summit and Washington's threat to send more troops to Eastern Europe in case of attack. Eastern Europe, but not Ukraine itself, a member of NATO. And that's where the Kremlin's own red lines start. The Russian president wants the West to recognize that this former Soviet state is off limits to the kind of westernization seen in, say, the Baltic republics. It's not just Vladimir Putin who thinks that. Russians see Ukraine as part of their sphere of influence, kind of like Belarus. We'll ask about that perception and how it may be evolving, and what Ukrainians themselves want. How do they feel about Russia? Russia the nation? Russia the culture? What the Ukrainian president himself, a native Russian speaker. 7 years after the Maidan revolution in Kiev and Moscow's annexation of Crimea, are we witnessing the theatrics of a frozen conflict? Or is it about to get a lot more volatile? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking about Ukraine's red lines. Joining us from Washington, he was U.S. ambassador to Ukraine from 2003 to 2006. John Herbst is senior director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council. Thanks for being with us.
Good evening. It's happy to be here.
From Moscow, Alexandra Filipenko, senior research fellow at the Russian Academy of Sciences Institute for U.S. and Canadian Studies. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Former German ambassador to NATO, Joachim Bitterlich, joins us. Welcome back.
Hello.
And Uzbek-born Russian-American journalist Vladislav Davidzon, you are too, our non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council, and the author of From Odessa with Love. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The France 24 debate, where you can join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, hashtag F24Debate. Well, Ambassador Herbst, let me begin with you. We unfortunately did not have microphones in the room during that discussion, but the common sense says that they did broach substance.
I don't have any doubt they broached substance, and I think it's highly likely that the principal subject of discussion was Ukraine and Moscow's threatened major aggression against Ukraine. And I suspect as well that they both said in private pretty much what they've said in public and that their senior aides said in public in the days leading up to this event. Biden warned Putin that, in fact, if he escalates his current aggression in Donbas by sending tens of thousands or 100,000 Russian troops into Ukraine, that the United States and the West will respond with punishing sanctions, increased military assistance to Ukraine, and positioning of more NATO forces on the eastern NATO countries closer to Russia's border. And I suspect Mr. Putin reiterated some of the red lines that have appeared recently in Russian official statements regarding NATO-Ukraine relations and a NATO presence in Ukraine.
Is this video call a good thing? What do you make of it?
Well, to my mind, a result of a demobilization of the major Russian military presence on Ukraine without actual increased aggression is the desired outcome. And I think we may well get there, but we're not going to get there as a result of simply this one summit. But the way to get there is to make sure that Mr. Putin understands that the warnings Biden and others have been sending are real. Because Moscow already loses 1 to 1.5% of its GDP a year as a result of existing sanctions. And the sanctions that we are discussing today would at least double that and probably more. And of course, additional military assistance and repositioning of NATO forces underscores to the Kremlin that an invasion of Ukraine would in fact worsen their security circumstances. And this is, I think, the way to manage this crisis.
All right, we're starting to get statements from that meeting, and I'll read to you as we speak, Alexandra Filipenko, one of them, the White House putting out a statement saying that the U.S. president reiterated, quote, his support for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity and called for a de-escalation and a return to diplomacy. Now, these are the usual statements, I suppose. What is really concretely, in your view, the desired outcome wanted by the Kremlin from this meeting?
To be honest, to my mind, I think the Kremlin already got what they wanted. They actually wanted a discussion with the U.S. president one-on-one, a discussion that followed up the discussion between the leaders of United States and China. And for Russia, for Kremlin, for President Putin, it is extremely important to showcase that he is just as an important figure on the international stage as the leader of China. So I guess they already got what they wanted on all the military troops build up by the Ukrainian border was somehow leading to this meeting. And we know Antony Blinken said that the U.S. support for Ukraine is unwavering. He said it a few times, and also after the meeting between Secretary Blinken and Minister Lavrov. So any escalation by Russia would have serious consequences. We knew that. And I must say that for Russia, for President Putin, it is just extremely important to sit one-on-one, even though it's an online meeting, but we understand that as of now, there are no one-on-one meetings as there used to be. So to my mind, Russia already got what it wanted.
So does that mean we can expect a de-escalation anytime soon?
Hopefully. That's my view, that now when President Putin already showed his, let's say, might, now there would be some kind of an escalation because we've been talking about Cold War 2.0. We've been talking about it for so long. And now I guess that maybe there would be some strategic arms limitations, some new treaties. And for the United States, it's important to have Russia as a partner in Indo-Pacific region. So talking about intermediate range and short-range missiles and China. So I guess, I hope, cautiously optimistic regarding a de-escalation.
Okay, so let me put it to you, Vladislav Davidson, then, because that's an important point just made there by Alexandra. One of the things the Russians have been keen on is a full wholesale review of sort of the architecture of security in today's world. Would the Biden administration go along with that? And with that, would they be right to go along with a full-scale review of who gets to put troops where, what does military deployment mean, and that sort?
I do think that the Biden administration has made serious mistakes in foreign policy over the last couple of months, which have let us into the situation where the Kremlin thinks that they would be mailable or at least pushable into a kind of review that probably they would not want to if they were...
We agree to disagree on Ukraine, but let's talk about more broadly the architecture of today's security architecture of today's world.
I think it's obvious, and I published an op-ed, a open letter in the Wall Street Journal 2 days ago saying that the Biden administration has been, let's say, interested in a reset without actually using that word, interested in the way that every American president has tried to get a reset with Moscow when coming to power since Clinton. This would be the fifth president in the row who would want to try a reset and would probably get his fingers burned in the process. But I do think that this administration has other big targets in mind and that they would like to see this problem go away. They obviously do not want another foreign policy catastrophe on their watch in less than 6 months, but they would be happy if this situation could be dissolved somehow without them looking weak.
Without them looking weak, well, there's plenty of muscle flexing that's been going on both sides. Yes, there's the troop buildup on the Russian side, but there's also that military hardware made in the USA that was on full display Monday when Ukraine celebrated Armed Forces Day in places like Kharkiv and the port of Odessa. There you see the parade there. There's also been delivery of two U.S. Coast Guard ships to Ukraine. These images from 3 weeks ago, ahead of patrols in the Black Sea by the USS Porter, that's a guided missile destroyer, and the command ship of the U.S. 6th Fleet, the USS Mount Whitney, routine patrols, says NATO. They're never routine, says Russia, which sees any such exercises in the Black Sea as a provocation. Joachim Bitterlich, would you say that this isn't that big a deal? Would you agree with what you just heard from Vladislav on how the U.S. views this?
First of all, I think for Moscow, this meeting is of extreme importance. It shows for them the equal footing with Washington, to be considered as an equal partner at, let's call it, world level. And Ukraine is one aspect in this. And I think the Russians, on the one hand, they have been trying, let's say, to set a new agenda concerning Ukraine. And this agenda has been set by, especially by the Americans in the past, by Bush Jr., offering NATO accession to the Ukraine. I think a wrong step in my eyes. And this has put us into, let's say, a mission impossible nearly. And now this could be, today's telephone call could be a first step of de-escalation, but only a first step. Others will have to follow.
But you heard Vladislav saying how this is appeasement. This is trying to hit a reset button without thinking it through.
It's normal for Biden, after Trump's time, to look for a certain reset of foreign policy. Either he's going in the wrong or in the right direction, a reset in this sense. And I think he has to reconsider to some extent how to develop the relationship with Moscow. And the Americans, in my eyes, have to learn again to take seriously Moscow as a rival, as a partner, as a cooperation partner. And this is, for me, the new agenda. It's nearly, that's it today, not a mission impossible, but to some extent is an embarrassing situation for the Western world, as for the East too, because the Russians know exactly under normal means, it's not possible, let's say, to take back Ukraine into the Russian sphere, as they have done with Belarus. And please don't compare the Baltic states with Ukraine. Ukraine, for the Russians, is a special case and remains a special case. Historically, for any Russian, this is part of Russia, this is of Mother Russia, if you want, Ukraine. And therefore, we have been crossing the red lines from the Western side, for them, in their perception. And there is still this certain paranoia on the Russian side. It's true to being encircled, it's clear. But on the other hand, for them, it's the West has been crossing the red lines. But the West is in an embarrassing situation. We have to recognize, and it's normal for us, under the auspices of OSCE, that we have to recognize and to protect the territorial integrity of the Ukraine as an independent state. But all this story behind this, there is a certain, let's say, an agreement, a disagree between the Western world and Russia from the beginning. For the Western world, the dissolution of the Soviet Union has created new states. We have to protect, recognize these states. And for the Russians, well, at least concerning Ukraine, this is not a real independence. It's a sort of autonomy. And there is the whole case in it.
All right. That's the disagreement you can never get over, John Herbst. You agree?
I agree that the problem is that Moscow refuses to recognize Ukraine's real independence. And I agree with my German colleague that among the Russian elite, this is a fairly held view. Mm. It's also true that this means if we accept it, we have to accept this is how they feel. Mm. But if we allow them to pursue policies on that basis, we are denying Ukrainians their own ability to determine their future.
Yes.
And this is the crux of the matter.
Yes.
Does Ukraine matter? Does Ukraine have the ability to choose its own future? I think I disagree with my German colleague. I think we need to make sure Ukraine is able to do that. And I think that the NATO issue is actually a red flag. It's a false issue. It's been clear since the Bucharest NATO summit in 2008 that Ukraine was not going to join NATO anytime soon. And Moscow began its aggression in Ukraine after Ukraine decided it wanted a free and deep and comprehensive free trade agreement with the EU. The current crisis is a direct result of Moscow saying no to that. Not even Ukraine joining the EU, but Ukraine having a closer economic relationship with Brussels. That's where this comes from.
All right, so let's pick up on that point about this NATO membership or not. You mentioned that 2008 summit in Bucharest. Let's listen to what happened at the State Department briefing on Monday. They were asked again, what about Ukraine joining NATO? And as you'll hear, the United States never says no.
Well, look, we have been clear, as have past administrations of both parties, that NATO has an open door. And we are committed to the open door policy that was put forward in Bucharest, that NATO should remain an option to aspirants when they are ready and able to meet the commitments that are spelled out, as well as the obligations of membership that are spelled out.
So before I go back to John Herbst, Alexander Filipenko, when Russians hear that, is it like a red rag to a bull? Or do they know that this is just the Americans kicking the can down the road another time? There's not going to be a NATO membership for Ukraine anytime soon.
Well, we know that Russian propaganda is scaring everyone with the Ukraine joining NATO, and somehow it should make a difference. Although, if we're talking about strategic stability, it doesn't really make a difference. The difference that was made by, for example, Baltic states joining NATO. And I would absolutely agree with Mr. Bitterlek that Ukraine and as well as Belarus is very special for Russia. So talking about that NATO eastward expansion that we've been hearing in 1990s all the time, over and over again, it used to be very important because the missile flight time was much further before that. For now, missiles could be put in the Baltic states, and the flight time is like 120 seconds, and from Ukraine it would be 110 seconds. So a 10-second difference, actually. So all that NATO eastward expansion, if we're talking about strategic stability, if we're talking about missiles, it doesn't really make that kind of a difference. But for Russia, as Mr. Bitterlek absolutely correctly said, Ukraine and Belarus is very special for Russia historically and politically. I don't want to bore you with details, but just one thing. When Italy was created, when Camillo Cavour said that famous phrase, "We created Italy, now we have to create Italians," it was said in like 1860s when Italy was united. So Ukraine really was, let's say, born only in after the Maidan Revolution, and Belarus started their birth process, if I can put it this way, only in August 2020. So for Russia, of course, it's Russian sphere of influence. I would say Kremlin sphere of influence.
But do they still see it? Excuse me, Alexander. Do they still see it as part of their sphere of influence? It's been 7 years, right, since the Maidan Revolution. That's a long time. Do they still see it? Do they know deep down that this government is not going to be a vassal state for?
It's been many years. It's in 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed, and still Russia, Kremlin, still sees Kiev as its sphere of influence. It still sees Minsk as its sphere of influence. And even though, as you correctly said, 7 years since the Maidan, the final Maidan, and but still for Russia, Ukraine is a very, very special, and I would say, dear part of former Soviet Union. We know that, for example, again, talking about Baltic states, I'm sorry for comparing, countering Mr. Bitterlich, but I'm comparing. Russian language wasn't that important, and it wasn't a state language. But in Ukraine, in Belarus, everyone speaks Russian. And in Russia, there are so many Ukrainians, even my surname is actually Ukrainian with O at the end. There are so many Russians in Ukraine. And they still, unfortunately, still see this independent state as part of Russian sphere of influence.
And now we have this conflict that seems frozen on the front line. It looks right now, after 7 years, like a never-ending war. France 24 correspondent Gulliver Cragg went to the town of Advika, that's near Donetsk. He filed this report.
Thanks largely to its gargantuan coking plant, Avdiivka has remained a bustling town despite being right on the front line. Most people here don't like to talk about the war.
No comment. Пошли.
Новости вообще стараюсь не смотреть. Чтоб и так тут жизни свою дала.
On the southern edge of town, though, this is the landscape. A warren of bombed-out factory buildings forms part of the Ukrainian line of defence. There's fighting nearly every day. Russian-backed forces are less than 100 meters from here.
Послідовності дій немає. Тобто в будь-який час може пролунати будь-який постріл.
To the lieutenant, will Russia invade Ukraine is not the right question.
Росія вже якби на території України. Не треба нікого переконувати, от коли збройні сили України беруть в полон когось. Знаходиться з російськими документами, у нього російський паспорт, російський військовий квиток.
Still, the troops here say they don't expect a major escalation in fighting.
Постоянно говорять, що якесь наступлення буде, постоянно скупчення військової техніки. Тому я не вірю. З цієї сторони будуть великі втрати.
The front line in Donbass has not moved significantly for nearly 7 years, but the situation remains unstable. Russia does not accept Ukraine's pro-Western geopolitical orientation, and Ukraine does not accept the occupation of part of its territory by the Kremlin's forces. 5 kilometers from the front line, this community center is the work of active citizens of a town that oddly bears the name New York. They're very alarmed by the reports of Russia's troop buildup, particularly when the source is US intelligence.
Конечно, на этом фоне слышать о том, что будет еще хуже, не дай бог, но это, конечно же, тяжело. Уже там 7 лет войны, это очень тяжело.
А теперь понимаем, что она очень надолго затянется. Уже пришло такое понимание. Хватит на весь наш век.
The last time residential buildings in this town were shelled was as recently as 2019.
Vladislav Davidson, when this could go on for years and years, the way it's playing out, and the feeling is in those towns that you went to, what do they feel? What do they think of Russia today as opposed to 7 years ago?
On the Ukrainian side, there are lots of people who are displaced. I mean, there are IDPs in both directions. There are a lot of refugees out of Ukraine into other countries. There are a lot of people from the other parts of the Donbass, which are occupied by the Russian army and Russian-backed and controlled separatists.
And this is a Russian-speaking part of Ukraine.
Oh, yeah. This is a Russian-speaking part of Ukraine. And it's important to remember that not enough young men rose up to fight for them to get that entire part of the two regions which were taken under control. Both Lugansk and Donetsk did not field enough local separatist might and enough young men fighting in order to get the both these regions to go over to the side of the Russians. So I think lots of people just want this to end, and lots of people, it's just their life. There's nothing more permanent than a temporary solution. They are hoping that this goes away, and that they know, you know, there are people who have very difficult lives, who are living in border towns, who have to go back and forth across the checkpoints of both sides to pick up their pension. Those people have really, really difficult lives. Sometimes it takes 48 hours just to cross the border checkpoints. I don't envy those people. Neither do I envy the people who live in Avdiivka or one of those little towns on the contact line. It's a very difficult life.
A very difficult life. John Herbst, when you think back two decades ago, did you see this coming?
When I served in Ukraine from 2003 to 2006. I was there for the Orange Revolution. When I arrived in Ukraine in 2003, without a doubt, the most popular politician in Ukraine was Vladimir Putin. Mm. After Putin's intervention in the Ukraine election of 2004, he basically lost the support of the center of the country, Kyiv and others, but he still retained support in the east. Mm. With his backing of Yanukovych, repression of Ukrainians in the winter of 2013 and 14, and now his invasion of Ukraine in Donbas, his seizure of Crimea, his popularity in Ukraine has tanked. He is considered a villain by most Ukrainians, including those in the east. This is a direct result of his aggression against Ukraine. So I'm not going to tell you I anticipated this. I was not surprised when Putin seized Crimea after the Maidan in February of 14. I was surprised when he began his war in Donbas. But his war in Donbas has been a failure because he thought he'd create a quote-unquote Nova Russia in a good portion of the east, and he only has a relatively small enclave. Because the people in the east, including the Russian speakers, including the ethnic Russians, wanted no part of this Russian aggression. And that remains a critical fact, which is why he's considering a major invasion, because he can't win this relying on the people living in eastern Ukraine. It's worth remembering that the first president of the Donetsk People's Republic was Alexander Baradai, mm-hmm. a polytechnologue, in other words, a political technologist from Moscow. Mm-hmm. And the first defense minister of that entity was the famous Gierkov Strelkin, an FSB officer.
So today, Alexandra Filipenko, ordinary Russians, is it something they talk about, the conflict in the Donbas, or is it kind of off the radar?
Well, of course, people who are interested in politics definitely talk about it. And it's on the minds of many Russians in this way or another. We know that propaganda TV channels talk about it all the time. It seems that there are no other issues, only United States and Ukraine. We know that there were more than almost 400,000 Russian passports given to in the Donbas region to Ukrainians to become Russian citizens. This way, Kremlin would have some influence there, more influence there. It was absolutely correctly mentioned by Mr. Herbst, Russia sees Ukraine, of course, as an important part for Europe, and of course, as it used to be a part of the Soviet Union. So, yes, Russians do speak about Ukraine, do see it Ukraine as an ally, actually, most Russians. But politicians, unfortunately, and the propaganda channels are doing their job. And for now, Ukraine is seen as an enemy.
Ukraine's seen as an enemy. And Ukraine's president, you could say, embodies that conflicted relationship between Kiev and Moscow. Volodymyr Zelensky, who we can show you on touring the front line on Monday during Armed Forces Day, was born in the center of the country into a Russian-speaking family. In fact, in a previous life, he was a stand-up comedian who made a living touring countries of the former Soviet Union. Here you see him before that television show where he played the role of Ukraine's president, which sprung him towards political life and life imitating fiction. Let me ask you about this, because Vladimir Putin refuses to meet Zelensky one-on-one. This talk about the West is talking about what the so-called Normandy format, whereby it would be with diplomats from Germany, from France, etc. What will it take for Vladimir Putin to meet Volodymyr Zelensky?
I think he would be ready to meet him at the end of the day, but within this special Normandy format, or the Minsk format, if you want. I think he would agree, because he is looking after a certain failure of his own policy towards a way, he's looking for a way out. The way out could be, on the one hand, taking over the Ukraine, but he is now assessing the risk of this. He is seeing it clearly, and therefore he's looking for, let's say, another way out where he is not the loser.
Because back in the spring, we had a spike in tension, then we had the Geneva summit. Now another spike in tension, the video call. How many times can we do it?
But the Geneva summit was the first summit to see each other. The first time again, equal footing between the US and the Russians. Now he needs this at home for home consumption. And therefore he is looking for a solution where he is not, at least not the loser. And where he sees even he can sell it at home as a winner. And politics is often, let's say, the art of finding out the feasible or doing the feasible at the end for both sides. There are no winners, no losers. And I think we are perhaps, I'm not sure yet, on a first step in towards such a way of at least an intermediate solution for the crisis.
I agree with Ambassador that President Putin is looking to figure out what he can get away with and what the costs are going to be. There are obviously going to be huge costs to starting a full-on conquest of large chunks of Ukraine, even taking a lot more territory as opposed to taking half the country, which would be a full-on...
But do you agree with Joachim Bitterlich when he says that this could be the opening so that there can be some kind of at least a face-saving exercise on the part of Putin?
Look, we are not at the same place that we were in the spring. This is a completely different situation, and events have moved, right? They've moved along in a direction where things are not as positive in terms of capacity to solve things. I do not think that the Kremlin any longer sees President Zelensky as a fair interlocutor. I do not think they're any more interested in actually talking to him for various reasons and because of the collapse of trust and the collapse of...
So could Zelensky get his attention like he did when he used those drones to... Those Turkish-made drones back in October to take out Russian-backed forces. If he gets his attention, will Putin be forced to speak with him or forced to take him on militarily?
He will take him on militarily if there is too much escalation from the Ukrainian side. But also, it's odd that no one here has yet voiced the words Nord Stream 2. I mean, my patron and friend, my boss, John Herbst, has spent the last weeks being, you know, very, very, very critical about his opposition to the Nord Stream 2 situation. This is the elephant in the room, and to a great extent...
Elephant, no.
No, not an elephant?
No.
You are a German, Your Excellency.
No, I have doubts. It's not the elephant in the room. To some extent, it's one of the possibilities of the West to react. And I think the Germans are aware of this.
That's why they've not commissioned, they've not started the pipeline yet?
There are other reasons, much more German reasons, that not many media understand in detail. It's a legal reason on the German side.
Okay.
Because the Germans are under a certain pressure on this. But please, Germany is not depending on Russian gas. There are other possibilities for the Germans to get the gas. What the Germans want to reach through this is, let's say, to maintain, let's say, the entry to a certain dialogue and discussion with the Russians.
Okay, this is
important.
That's
the key.
This is important because between the U.S. and Russia, there's Europe, and its biggest nation is indeed Germany. Once itself, by the way, torn in two by the Cold War. It's changing chancellors this Wednesday. Yes. Let's listen to the new guy in Berlin.
Just like everyone else in Europe and in the United States, we are worried about the troop movements we are seeing on the border with Ukraine, which is why it must be absolutely clear that it would be an unacceptable situation if Ukraine was threatened.
Wenn da eine Bedrohung entstünde für die Ukraine.
So, Ambassador Herbst, I know you're well versed in translating for us diplomatic ease. What do you make of the words of Olaf Scholz?
Look, I think Germany too recognizes how dangerous it would be for Europe if Moscow were to send a conventional army into Ukraine to conquer a substantial portion of the country. So he's sending a message also to Putin, don't do this. And that's a positive.
And your thoughts?
It's in line with Merkel's policy up to now.
In line with Merkel's policy, you expect continuity out of Berlin?
By and large, the SPD is weaker on Russia policy than the Christian Democrats. But by the same token, I think the new chancellor is as good as you'll get from the SPD. So I see a large amount of continuity. Mm. It's also true that the Greens are kind of tough on Russia. I think they correctly gauge Putin. And that will also add an element, a positive element in German policy towards Russia.
And what about France? Because we had a statement before Joe Biden debriefed the video call with Putin with his NATO allies from Italy, France, the UK, and Germany, saying that he is hoping that there'll be a process of going towards appeasing relations with Russia. Your thoughts on Emmanuel Macron's position. Is it the same as Germany's?
Did you say appeasing relations with Russia?
I'm maybe translating it wrong, but he talked about an appeased climate. That is to say, a more
not appeasement.
I understand.
Not
I
appeasement, understand. but a more pacific climate with Russia.
It's worth
less
remembering.
Conflictual.
It's worth remembering that 100 years ago, appeasement was not a dirty word the way it is today.
Right.
So one should be careful with its use.
Something gets lost in translation.
It is. I'm not faulting you. I'm just saying if that was being used in Paris, that would be a mistake.
Right.
Look, it is clear that in the West, Germany and France have not been as strong on dealing with Kremlin provocations. And Putin's been pursuing an explicitly revisionist foreign policy, at least for the last 15 years. And they have not been as strong as the United States, and the United States has not been as strong as it should be on this. We should not be worrying about accommodating Moscow or making them feel easy. We should be concerned about making sure Moscow understands that its provocations will be met with a strong response. Mm. Once that is clear in Moscow, we can talk about an easing. But talking about an easing prematurely only enhances the position of those in Moscow who want to continue pursuing aggressive foreign policy.
Alex,
the critical thing is to make them understand aggression and provocations do not work for them. That's key. Everything else follows from that basis.
Alexander Filipenko, do you agree it doesn't really matter that much who's the leader of France? Who's the leader of Germany? When you're sitting in Moscow, it's all about who's in the White House.
Yes.
Well,
it looks like
for Moscow, for Kremlin, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Only matters who is in the White House.
And right now, when you look at the way things are unveiling, Russia has this perennial advantage in one respect, geography. It's always going to matter more, isn't it, Alexandra, when Ukraine is next door as opposed to across the ocean?
Yes, also that. And again, talking about the spheres of influence for as we know, for the United States, American continent, I mean, Canada and Mexico have always been in their sphere of influence, and it wouldn't change since geographically it wouldn't change. Russia sees Eastern Europe also as part of its sphere of influence because of geography, of course. And again, that is historically, and there are so many connections,
but again, we heard about those connections becoming fraught of late, as described by John Herbst. And just one last point on this, Vladislav Davidson, you know, we're going to be coming up on the 30th anniversary of the end of the Soviet Union. I mean, some of the key figures, Leonid Brezhnev, Leon Trotsky, they were Ukrainians.
Trotsky was a Jew from Odessa. He was retrospectively Ukrainian. It is absolutely true that the Ukrainians are to the Russians within the context of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union, the way the Scottish were to the English, as in a junior partner in an imperial model, in the way that the Irish did not have the same status and didn't have an aristocracy. They didn't always have people in parliament. They didn't always have generals. You could be, and I've said this before, a Russified Ukrainian aristocrat, or you could be a Russified Ukrainian general in the Tsar's army, or you could be a secretary general of a communist party. I myself was born in Uzbekistan because lots of Russians and Ukrainians and Jews, and I'm all three, were sent to Central Asia as part of a traditional imperialist policy. This is how you run an imperialist country. I was born in the outskirts of an empire because my parents and grandparents were, nomenklatur custodians of an imperial legacy, and they were from Ukraine and they were from Belarus. They were sent there after World War II. And
is that bond still there today?
I mean, look, the Ukrainians. When Russians say fraternal people, this sends off red signals in Ukraine and in Kyiv. I mean, I have boundaries with my cousins. We don't share bank accounts and kitchens, right? I mean, obviously, Ukrainians and Russians are both Slavs, and a lot of Ukrainians are Orthodox, and there's no way for me to know who's who when I talk to anyone in Kyiv or Odessa. I have no idea what's in people's heads until they tell me my grandmother was Russian or my grandfather is Ukrainian. There are lots of Ukrainians fighting, people with Ukrainian last names fighting in the Donbas, and there are lots of Russian speakers and ethnic Russians fighting for the Ukrainian army and in the volunteer battalions. And even amongst the really the more conservative right-wing Ukrainian volunteer battalions, most of them are Russian speakers. So it's entirely about identity, and it's not about ethnicity, and it's not about race. It's a very complex construct of identity issues.
Well, let's hope that today was, as he's hoping, Ambassador Biderlich, the beginning of some sort of de-escalation. I want to thank you very much, Vladislav Davidson. I want to thank Joachim Biderlich, John Herbst in Washington, Alexandra Filipenko in Moscow. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.